Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 6, 2023 issue of the Week. Cover drawing this week is takes place on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Senator John Fetterman is standing there in his characteristic hoodie and long shorts and athletic shoes. He's got a thumbs up in his left hand. His right hand, he's holding a necktie. And Chuck Schumer is also dressed in a hoodie and shorts and athletic shoes, and he's holding a lighter and setting the necktie on fire. In the background, seated at one of the desks, is Senator Joe Manchin. He's got his arms crossed and a stern look on his face. The headline is "A Casual Insult: Why Many Lawmakers Are Fuming Over the Senate's New Dress Code." That comes up in our Controversy of the Week, but we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. House GOP flails as shutdown looms. What happened? Senate Democrats and Republicans reached a deal this week to fund the government through mid-November, but with hard-right GOP House members declaring that plan DOA, the nation appeared headed for an October 1st showdown as the week went to press. The Senate voted 77-19 to advance a bill that would fund the government for 6 weeks and included some $6 billion each for aid in Ukraine and for domestic disaster relief. But the proposal was declared a non-starter by many in the far-right House Freedom Caucus, who oppose any stopgap measure at all. "It's not going to happen over here," said Representative Greg Murphy, Republican from North Carolina. Hardliners were egged on by former President Donald Trump. "Unless you get everything," he posted online, "shut it down." That left House Speaker Kevin McCarthy with the option of trying to push the Senate bill with support from House Democrats. But such an effort would likely lead fellow Republicans to seek his ouster. After failing to unite around a short-term spending bill loaded with cuts, House Republicans focused on long-term appropriations bills. They drafted measures that would fund defense, agriculture, homeland security, and the State Department, while cutting nearly $3.8 billion from agriculture and foreign aid programs. But it wasn't certain they had the votes for those bills, sure to be rejected by the Senate, to clear even the House. In his latest pivot, McCarthy called for a meeting with President Biden and shifted his focus to the U.S.-Mexico border, saying any deal would have to increase funding for border security. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Biden would not meet with McCarthy, explaining, "It's up to the Speaker to twist in the wind." What the editorial said: "We seem to be barreling toward a shutdown," said the South Florida Sun Sentinel. "And you can thank a temper tantrum by overgrown toddlers who'd rather damage America than govern responsibly. McCarthy could pull us back from the edge, but he's hostage to a chaos caucus that will grab for his gavel at the first hint of any responsibility on his part. The only way forward is to marginalize these radicals, but that would require a speaker with a spine. This is a losing game for Republicans," said National Review. "They'll almost certainly be blamed for a shutdown, as they have been three times in the past decade. For Republicans to use whatever leverage they've got to push fiscal responsibility is healthy, but blowing up consensus, even within their own caucus, is foolhardy and self-defeating. The obvious GOP play is to pass something, anything, and negotiate from there. But a small contingent of bomb throwers is leading the party off a cliff. What the columnist said. McCarthy is at a crossroads, said Nick Popley in Time. With GOP extremists dug in, it's hard to see how he can pass any funding bill at all, let alone one that would be accepted by the Democrat-controlled Senate. That gives him a choice. Shut down the government, which would anger many voters but save his standing with the hardliners, or work with Democrats to pass a short-term bill that could avert or end a shutdown, but possibly at the expense of his own speakership. Everybody loses in a shutdown, said Neil Bradley in USA Today. The five that the U.S. has had since 1995 have one thing in common. They all failed to achieve the instigator's goals. And shutdowns do real damage to real people. Mortgage applications and small business loans are delayed. Contractors who service federal agencies can face layoffs and insolvency. And government permits are put on hold, slowing everything from energy production to commercial fishing. This is not a time for games, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. The U.S. has so far dodged the recession that usually follows a period of high inflation. But if Republicans force a shutdown, they will be stressing the economy at roughly the worst possible time and amping up the risk. That won't bother the hardliners, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. They've shed the pretense of actual conservatism in favor of a permanent pose of performative radicalism. A corrupt establishment is the enemy, and to make any concession is to sell out the cause. If that costs the GOP control of the House and hurts the economy, not to worry. Fighting a losing battle would just prove how principled they are. And a second shorter main story. Trump found to have committed wide-ranging fraud. Donald Trump defrauded banks and insurers for years by massively overvaluing his assets. A New York judge ruled this week in a decision that could cripple the former president's business empire. The ruling was an early victory for New York Attorney General Letitia James and her civil lawsuit against the former president, which argues that he inflated his annual net worth by up to $3.6 billion to get favorable terms on loans and insurance deals. State Supreme Court Justice Arthur F. Engoron included a raft of details of the misstatements Trump made in official filings between 2011 and 2021. In one instance, Trump claimed that his Manhattan penthouse was almost three times its actual size. In another, he said his Mar-a-Lago estate was worth $600 million rather than the appraised value of $27 million, an overvaluation of 2,300%. In defendant's world, Engoron wrote, restrictions can evaporate into thin air. That is a fantasy world. Trump, who is expected to appeal, called the ruling Democrat political lawfare. The decision is a blow to Trump's businesses as it strips him of control of several key New York properties and places some of the hundreds of companies that make up the Trump Organization into receivership, although it wasn't clear whether those would be sold off or managed by court-appointed receivers. The trial in James' lawsuit is expected to begin next week, but since Engoron has already established fraud, the main issue at stake is what fine Trump might face. What the columnist said. This ruling reveals that the fraud that built it all, said Charlie Sykes in The Bulwark. Before any of Trump's many other scandals and legal battles, including his four criminal indictments, came the lie, his fabulous wealth. Now the whole gaudy superstructure of golden toilets and skyscrapers turns out to be a racket in plain sight, tottering on inflated values, stiff contractors, and unpaid taxes. So much for the family business. Sons Eric and Donald Jr. were also held liable. The revelations go straight to the heart of the identity that made Trump a national figure, said Maggie Haberman and Alan Foyer in the New York Times. For decades, he relentlessly promoted an image of himself as a master of the business world. That deception won him 14 seasons on The Apprentice and helped him build the following that won him the presidency. By effectively calling him a cheat, Engoron has undermined Trump's very brand. Yet the ruling is unlikely to have much effect on the 2024 presidential race, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon. Even though former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen predicts that the potential fine, James is seeking $250 million, could bankrupt him, don't expect MAGA loyalists to desert. Trump has trained his followers to believe that any attempt to hold him accountable is a conspiracy. The more proof that is presented of Donald Trump's corruption and criminality, the more they respect and revere him. The controversy of the week. Decorum. Does it matter what senators wear? When the history of the decline of American institutions is written, said Rich Lowry in National Review, John Fetterman's hoodie will deserve at least a footnote. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer last week instructed the Senate's Sergeant at Arms to stop enforcing the chamber's unofficial dress code, which for decades has required a suit and a tie for men and dresses with covered shoulders or pantsuits for women. This appeared to be a personal favor to Senator Fetterman, who is now free to dress like a slob and stroll the floor in his trademark hooded sweatshirt and shorts. Republican outrage was swift, with 46 GOP senators demanding Schumer reinstate the dress code to preserve the Senate's honor and tradition. It wasn't just Republicans, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Senator Joe Manchin is circulating a petition to reverse the change, while Schumer's number two, Senator Dick Durbin, said, "We need to have standards." It's hard to disagree. Yes, a suit and tie can be constraining, especially one imagines for the 6'8" Fetterman. But like a judge's black robe, senators' formal attire speaks to the solemnity of their work. Abandoning the code puts the Senate on a slippery slope to fashion mayhem. How long before attention-seeking lawmakers start showing up in T-shirts emblazoned with inflammatory partisan messages, or the logos of favorite sports teams? With everything Congress has on its plate, Ukraine, immigration, a government shutdown, are we really having a heated debate about gym shorts? Asked Christina Cotarucci in Slate. Who cares if Senator Susan Collins shows up to work in a bikini, as she jokingly threatened last week? What matters is how senators vote. And this concern for tradition was in notably short supply when Senate Republicans blocked President Obama's judicial nominees or tried to overturn the 2020 election. I'm proud of Fetterman, said Stephanie Farr in the Philadelphia Inquirer. His refusal to play the Senate's sartorial game shows his solidarity with the blue-collar voters who elected him. Rather than the system changing him, he may have helped change the system. The Senate dress code was doomed anyway, said Bobby Gosch in Bloomberg. When the suit and tie rule for male senators was established, that was the ensemble of the American everyman. But we dress differently now. These days, most of us show up to work in some variant of the clothes we wear at home, especially since the pandemic. So why shouldn't our senators and representatives do likewise? Fetterman's critics clearly fear his dress-down style will diminish their elite status, said Robert Armstrong in the Financial Times. But in the age of the hoodie-wearing tech mogul, a suit is the uniform of the hustling salesman, and the billionaire's bodyguard, a signal that you work for someone else. Senators do work for someone else, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. They're public servants. Dressing like a grown-up, as you do the people's business, shows that you've internalized the idea of service and that personal comfort isn't number one in your hierarchy of concerns. It's also a key marker of group membership, said Rhonda Gerlich in the New York Times. In our bitterly divided Congress, the shared dress code is one of the last symbolic markers of accord, a reminder of the still noble goal of consensus. In these turbulent times, are there weightier questions facing the Senate than Fetterman's hoodie and shorts? Yes and no. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for Jimmy Carter, who days before celebrating his 99th birthday and some 7 months after entering hospice care, attended a peanut festival in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. In my opinion, he is one of the toughest men to serve as president, said 12-year-old festival attendee Reed Elliott, and he is my favorite. It was a good week for Happy Little Trees. After a walk in the woods, the first oil painting dashed off by Bob Ross on his beloved PBS show The Joy of Painting 40 years ago sold at auction in Minnesota for $9.8 million. It was a good week for salvation after a vicar in the English town of St. Ives installed a working set of beer pumps in his 600-year-old church for a local arts festival, leading some parishioners to accuse him of desecration. Above all, said Reverend Nick Widows, we want people to come in and have a positive experience of their time here. But it was a bad week for consumer price indexes after New York Times columnist David Brooks posted a photo on X of a burger and fries meal he said cost him $78 at Newark Airport, commenting, "This is why Americans think the economy is terrible." Online sleuths soon determined only $17 of the tab was for food and the remainder for the bar bill. It's a bad week for renewables after a homeowner in the Dutch town of Doorn arranged solar panels on his roof to spell out a slang term for penis. "We have to decide if this is acceptable or not," said a town official. "You don't need a permit for solar panels, but that does not mean you can just do what you like." Finally, it was a bad week for first pets after President Biden's German Shepherd commander bit another Secret Service agent, the dog's 11th biting incident. A White House staffer said the president and first lady were working to help commander cope with the oft unpredictable nature of the White House. Here's a short and other news piece. Supreme Court again rejects Alabama's election map. The Supreme Court this week cleared the way for the creation of a second majority black voting district in Alabama, rejecting an emergency request from the state to use a map drawn by Alabama's Republican-controlled legislature. In June, the court ruled that Alabama's proposed map, in which only one out of seven districts would be majority black, even though 27% of the population is black, diluted black voting power and voted and violated the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Alabama's legislature then drew a new map, which again failed to include a second majority black district. A three-judge federal panel found that the legislature had brazenly defied the Supreme Court's order. The panel will now select from three voting maps created by a court-appointed special master. title of the briefing this week is A Reckoning Over Looted Art. Thousands of artifacts in U.S. and European collections were stolen from their countries of origin. Should they be sent back? How big is the stolen art market? The illicit trade in cultural goods, from ancient friezes to coins and works of modern art, is estimated to be worth $10 billion a year, according to UNESCO. In the U.S. alone, the FBI's art crime team has over the past 20 years recovered some 20,000 pieces collectively valued at more than $900 million. Resolving a case can be as simple as returning a burglarized painting to its owner, but often it means reckoning with much larger wrongs. Thousands of works that were looted amid war, genocide, or colonial occupation can be found in some of the world's most distinguished museums and private collections. In recent years, activists and governments have launched campaigns to get artworks returned to their countries of origin, achieving considerable success. More than 50 international restitutions have taken place this year. In recent weeks, U.S. investigators have seized from American museums ancient Roman sculptures thought to have been looted from Turkey in the 1960s, and paintings by expressionist Egon Schiele, which the Nazis stole from a Holocaust victim. Restitution of such works is more than a legal matter of who has clear title, said Elizabeth Campbell, an expert in art collection ethics. It's a moral issue. Who are the key players in this trade? Over centuries, they've included thieves, smugglers, unscrupulous art dealers, and nations extracting tribute from conquered peoples. Europe's contact with the New World birthed a brisk trade in pre-Columbian artifacts, the fallout of which continues to be felt today. In March, the Mexican government repatriated an Earth Monster, a one-ton stone sculpture from the ancient Olmec civilization, after U.S. authorities seized it from a private collector in Colorado. More recently, looting sprees occurred during the Khmer Rouge's reign in Cambodia, the Iraq War, and the Arab Spring, with artifacts being funneled to foreign buyers. Since early 2022, Russian troops have, with the guidance of Russian art experts, emptied museums in occupied Ukraine. 10,000 of the 14,000 works in the Kherson Art Museum were taken. They were hunting for historic objects, said Ihor Poshevelo, a Ukrainian curator. Have museum officials aided looting? Until the late 20th century, many Western curators had an Indiana Jones-like approach to cultural treasures. Grab them and run. Thomas Hoving, a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who later became its director, once extracted a Romanesque relief from an Italian church with the help of a dealer who hid pilfered objects in his station wagon. My collecting style was pure piracy, Hoving wrote in his memoir. Gary Viken, a former director in Baltimore's Walters Art Museum, said the curating world of the 1980s was the Wild West. You wanted to be the one that gets the icon, the sculpture, the bronze. What changed? Laws, and eventually attitudes. A 1954 Hague Convention banned the looting of or destruction of cultural artifacts in wartime. A landmark 1970 UNESCO convention extended that prohibition, and most museums will today no longer take possession of an object without documentary proof that it was legally exported after 1970. Buying standards were further tightened in the 2000s amid outrage over the rampant plundering of ancient sites following the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The craft chain Hobby Lobby, whose evangelical owners are interested in the biblical Middle East, bought some 5,500 allegedly stolen clay tablets, talismans, and other objects for $1.6 million. Those items were eventually repatriated to Iraq as part of a 2017 settlement with the U.S. government. But some museum officials say it's wrong to assume that items in long-established collections are ill-gotten and, after so many years, should be sent back. Why do they oppose restitution? In many cases, it's because they believe their institutions are the rightful owners. In the early 19th century, British aristocrat Lord Elgin sailed home from Greece with statues and friezes that had once adorned the Parthenon in Athens. The removal, he said, was approved by local Ottoman officials. The Elgin marbles are now a star attraction at the British Museum in London, but Greece considers them part of its cultural patrimony and has long petitioned for their return. Earlier this year, then-British Cultural Minister Michelle Donnellan said such a repatriation would open a complete can of worms, leading other nations to make restitution requests of the museum. Many of those countries, some curators argue, are not safe for cultural resources. What's the problem? War, poverty, corruption, and shoddy infrastructure in developing nations can leave artifacts vulnerable to damage, theft, and decay. Some experts consider those solid arguments for leaving looted works where they are, in well-secured museums visited by millions from around the world. Where else on our planet can we bring together under one roof the fruits of 2 million years of human endeavor, said George Osborne, head trustee of the British Museum and former chancellor of the Exchequer. But others, especially non-Westerners, detect echoes of patronizing colonial attitudes in such humanitarian appeals. It is painful that others always want to teach us about how we preserve our heritage, said Beninese art historian Didier Honaud, that these others have themselves painstakingly destroyed. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two this week come from the U.S. McConnell is not going anywhere. Senator Mitch McConnell is not well, said Eli Mistel. You don't need to be an MD to know that an 81-year-old who has suffered a string of falls and freezes likely has a serious health problem. If the Senate Minority Leader were an ordinary person, he would retire. But McConnell is far from normal. A lifelong operator who wouldn't turn on a light switch unless it somehow helped Republicans, the Kentuckian likely thinks retirement is not an option. That's because his deep red home state has a Democratic governor, Andy Beshear, who will pick McConnell's temporary replacement if he steps down. McConnell has tried to block a Democrat from taking his seat even briefly, backing a 2021 state law requiring the governor to choose a replacement from the departing senator's party. But some conservative legal scholars suspect that law violates the 17th Amendment, which grants governors the power to fill Senate vacancies, and Beshear would almost certainly challenge its constitutionality in court. Whether McConnell retires gracefully or orders his staff to weaken at Bernie's him until his term ends in 2027 all depends on whether the popular Beshear wins re-election in November. McConnell may be unwell, but I doubt he's forgotten how to do politics. Newsom's telling veto of a trans bill. Gavin Newsom has woken up to the power of the parental rights movement, said Quinn Hillier. The California governor last week vetoed a truly monstrous bill passed by the Democratic-controlled state legislature, which would have required judges to consider whether parents have affirmed their child's gender identity while deciding custody cases. Any parent guilty of non-affirmation, even those who want to wait to see if the desire to transition is real or instead just a passing phase, could be stripped of custody by the state. Newsom didn't squelch this bill because it is sickening and dangerous, a fact the liberal governor made clear by praising its sponsor's passion and values. Rather, he dropped the axe because he has national political ambitions. He recognizes that a bill so outrageously treating parents as the enemy won't fly on the national stage. Outside of left-wing California, polls show most Americans believe a person's gender is determined at birth, and that medication for gender transition is a bad idea for children. Newsom recognizes that Democrats risk major political losses in suburbia if they continue to align themselves with radical transgender ideologues. The governor's veto is his way to avoid becoming political roadkill. This column comes from Mexico. Don't make friends with war criminals. Russia's participation in our recent Independence Day festivities has made Mexico a global embarrassment, said Aida Maria Hogun Baeza. At a time when Russian troops are committing war crimes against Ukrainians, there they were in the streets of Mexico, holding their flag high, marching alongside our own army in the annual parade. Ukraine's ambassador, Oksana Dramataretska, said the Russian presence had tainted the entire event. The hands and boots of these criminals are stained with blood, she said. Yet what should we have expected from a president who has steadfastly maintained neutrality in the war, refusing to sanction the Russian aggressor or send weapons to the Ukrainian victim? President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador actually professed not to understand the outrage over the Russian presence, since other nations also marched. Everyone is invited, he said. Why get upset over the Russians, he mused, but not the Chinese? The Mexican defense minister, meanwhile, said Russia's presence should be a source of pride, because Russia is a friend. That statement should horrify every Mexican. The truth is that we don't want Russia as an enemy, but we don't want it as a friend either. There are some countries that it is better not to befriend. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, The Spies Next Door. For two decades, the FBI rented a nondescript home in Washington, D.C., says Sylvie McNamara, a Washingtonian. Its best feature was an excellent view of the Russian embassy. In the mid-1980s, at a rundown group house on Upper Wisconsin Avenue, a woman named Monica heard a knock on her door. On her porch, she found two men claiming to be FBI agents. They asked if they could tune their listening devices from her attic. Gobsmacked, Monica looked them over. These men were clean-cut, nondescript, middle-aged, plausibly FBI. But how could she know for sure? She took down their information and sent them away. After all, they could be murderers or rapists. or they could be Soviet spies from the brand new embassy compound across the street. When Monica called the bureau about the men at her doorstep, nobody would confirm who they were. Nonetheless, she got the impression that it would be good to invite them back. The agents arrived dressed like dads, windbreakers, jeans, sneakers, hauling electronics equipment disguised as groceries. These groceries, they said, were devices for eavesdropping on the Soviets, which they used while circling the embassy compound in vans. Up they went to her attic, bags in tow. Then they left and never came back. A couple years later, the FBI turned up again, this time at the house next door. After decades as a family home, the property became a rental, and the new tenants struck the neighbors as strange. 7 days a week, teams of men rotated in and out of the house at eight-hour intervals, almost as if they were working in shifts. Often these men hauled large bags of Kodak film, which was probably for cameras, the ones that could sometimes be glimpsed through the house's tinted windows, but only when the sun hit just right. Those cameras were mounted on tripods, pointed at the embassy across the street. From roughly 1990 through 2013, neighbors say, 2619 Wisconsin Avenue was a spy house, an observation and listening post disguised as a residence. The FBI, of course, won't comment, but many of the locals will. For decades, the blocks surrounding the Russian embassy have been abuzz with odd stories. Secret tunnel, mouth for espionage, garages with blackened out windows, unexplained interference on phone calls, and a mysterious rooftop antenna array. Yes, this sounds like conspiracy theory, but most of it is probably true. If you strolled past Russian embassy in the upper reaches of Glover Park, you might not notice the house. It's a red brick colonial with straw-colored trim that blends in with the rest of the block. Nothing about it stands out, except maybe the windows, the three dark ones set into the roof. It's hard to say why they're conspicuous, though skylights don't normally face the street. The spy house's owner is Michael Massino. His grandfather built it around 1935. On the phone, he's terse and careful, insisting that he won't talk about anything about the house. True to his word, he doesn't divulge much. Why is it that you can't talk about your house? It's like my privacy. I'm prudent. Was there a tenant living there between 1990 and 2013? There was a tenant. Can you say anything else about that? Nope. Is it true that your house was a surveillance post? I have no comment on it. People say a lot of different things. While Massino is tight-lipped about the property, a half dozen neighbors are not. Their stories are consistent. Each day at 8 a.m., a team of agents would arrive at the house. These were typically men. They wore jackets and button-downs, and they drove dark, unmarked sedans. Another team replaced them at 4 p.m., then a third at midnight. The men didn't small talk, and they never discussed who they were. At the house, the shades were always drawn and the lights stayed off. Nobody was ever in the yard, and the garbage bins rarely went out. My sister would go over there all the time wanting to borrow sugar just to irritate them, said Kevin McDuffie, who lived one house down. But they'd sort of look out the blinds and not ever answer the door. As for hard proof of the spy house, Jim Popkin got about as close as it comes. In the late aughts, Popkin, then a reporter at NBC, was running on Wisconsin Avenue when the setting sun hit the house's tinted skylights, revealing a camera that couldn't ordinarily be seen. Intrigued, he ran the address through a database at work, and a name popped up as a resident. The man's listed occupation, clerk, really a spy. Popkin figures the guy wrote it as a joke on a washing machine warranty or magazine subscription, not realizing that Clark, really a spy, would get sucked into a database and follow him around. But it's basically the truth. The man turned out to be an FBI surveillance specialist. When Popkin got him on the phone, he was not thrilled to be speaking with a reporter, but he didn't deny that he worked at the house. The FBI didn't confirm or deny it either, though it asked Popkin not to print the specific address. Despite the Bureau's reticence, neighbors say the house was pretty overt. It wasn't like the FBI was trying to keep it a secret, McDuffie says, and if the neighbors knew about the spy house, then the Russians certainly did too. Apparently that's standard practice. The FBI watches the Russians, and the Russians know they're being watched. In the game of counterintelligence, as it's played across the globe, you must watch your adversary's embassy. You put eyes on all entrances and exits, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even on holidays, even when you're short on personnel. Every face and license plate is photographed. The time of each entrance and egress is logged. Day after day, you create copious and meticulous records. When someone gets sloppy, you hope it's the other side's people, not yours. Much of what you'll see is mundane. Diplomats coming to work, diplomats leaving to conduct diplomatic business, citizens applying for visas or passports, officials arriving for diplomatic events. But often things are not as they seem. Many diplomats are actually undercover intelligence officers. You'll never learn who unless you watch. In addition to watching, the house was probably listening, fishing around for electronic signals from which foreign secrets might be gleaned. There's phenomena all around the embassy that need to be picked up, said Andrew Hammond, a historian at the International Spy Museum. Radio chatter, phone calls, machine transmissions. To collect them, agents with gadgets probably lurked in the house across the street. While the FBI wouldn't have eavesdropped on the locals, neighbors sometimes felt the effects. Around the embassy, there's talk of electronic interference on phone calls and patchy TV reception. Then there was the incident with the garage door. When Bill Brownfield first moved to the street behind the spy house, his next-door neighbor told him something odd. For months, his garage door would open and close, unprovoked, at all hours of the day and night. The neighbor developed a theory that emanations between the embassy and the spy house were somehow triggering his electronic opener. Finally, he mentioned the issue to the guys at shift change. Apparently, it never happened again. James Olson, the CIA's former director of counterintelligence, said the neighbor's theory checks out. Garage doors open by electronic signal, he said, and when the FBI and the Russian embassy are in the area, there are going to be a lot of electronic signals going back and forth. In fact, he thinks most of the neighbor's observations make sense. Classified trash is typically incinerated, for instance, so of course no one was hauling bins to the curb, and the FBI often eavesdrops in vans rigged with listening devices, which periodically need to be tuned. During the Cold War, Olson himself was the target of a spy house, a spy apartment, actually. At the time, he worked for the State Department at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, but his real job was with the CIA. At the enormous residential building where he and other foreign diplomats lived, the activity on one floor was conspicuous. Every morning, we would see a lot of Russian workers going up to the fourth floor with big reels of tape under their arm, he says. They didn't make any bones about it. It was quite obvious that was their listening post. Because of the eavesdropping, Olson had to be scrupulously careful. He couldn't talk about his work or his personal problems, even in the privacy of his home. I was blanketed by KGB surveillance, he recalls, And it was very stifling, very oppressive, very threatening. The way the Russians monitored him, he says, is basically identical to how the FBI would have monitored the Russian embassy in D.C. Counterintelligence is counterintelligence, no matter which side is doing it. While the aura of mystery lingers, the spy house no longer hosts spies. Toward the end of 2013, Bill Brownfield stopped seeing the shift changes. Around that time, McDuffie says, the Messina family asked him to make discreet inquiries about selling the house and its adjoining vacant lot. Together, the house and lot were an attractive parcel for development. There was talk of a homeless shelter, then a facility for senior living, which caused some of the neighbors great angst. People were digging for any logical reason for why this would be a bad idea, Brownfield says. And one anti-development scheme took root. If the spy house were given historic landmark status, it couldn't be torn down. But its historic nature, its alleged surveillance mission, has still never been officially acknowledged, and to apply on those grounds required proof. In search of it, neighbors recruited someone to make inquiries, a senior government official who lives in a nearby house. This man, who asked not to be named, sniffed around various agencies to see if anyone might help. He said it was like pulling teeth. Then, after a couple months, came a response from a government official, essentially saying that while he couldn't confirm that the property had ever been used for surveillance, he could unofficially say that the federal government was no longer interested in the house. It wasn't enough for the historic landmark application, but it seemed to confirm the local hunch that the FBI had moved on. Where to? Well, obviously the Bureau won't say, but Jim Popkin points to clusters of cameras on telephone poles ringing the embassy, black globes that almost look like lamps. He's counted 41 of them in total, blanketing the surrounding blocks. It's possible the technology got so good that the FBI no longer needs humans to sit across the street and watch. As for the signals collection, Bill Brownfield has a theory. On the roof of an apartment building just up the street from the embassy, there's a phenomenal array of electronic equipment. I mean, antennas coming out of the wazoo. Next to them is a little structure that is kind of enclosed that Brownfield speculates may house particularly sensitive kinds of electronic equipment. But he acknowledges he'll probably never know. I bet you'll never get any human being in the world, unless it's a Russian speaker, to tell you where the team went. These days, the spy house is still standing. No development plans have yet come through. But the exterior has been transformed, the lights are on, the yard is covered in anti-Putin signs, and the porch is draped with blue and yellow flags. Instead of spying on the Russians, the house now seems bent on rankling them. Messina and his neighbors are loudly pro-Ukraine. Offered the opportunity to correct any misinformation about his house, Michael Messina declines. I'm just very cautious about talking to the media, he says. McDuffie, who lived next door for 2 decades, thinks Messina may have signed a NDA, but it's possible things will change. Asked if there's anything he wants to add, Messina is cryptic. In 10 years, we can talk again. This is adapted from a story that originally appeared in the Washingtonian. We'll read one of the health and science pieces. Flamingos now in many states. Look up. That might be a flamingo flying overhead. Ever since Hurricane Idalia roared across Florida at the end of August, Americans all up and down the East Coast have been spotting the huge pink birds in states that normally have none. As far north as Pennsylvania and Ohio, and all the way down to Texas. Experts say the birds, which usually only appear in the U.S. in the Florida Keys and in the Everglades, were probably flying between Cuba and Mexico when the storm blew them off course. More than 150 have been seen so far. In Rodanthe, North Carolina, a whole family of 11 birds was photographed waiting in Pamlico Sound. To my knowledge, which goes back like 50 years, there's never been anything as spectacular as this, Scott Duncan, head of Alabama Audubon, tells the Washington Post. This is jaw-dropping how many flamingos have been seen. Flamingos were common in Florida before they were hunted to the brink of extinction in the late 1800s. If the newcomers stick around, environmentalists hope the species might become established again. And over on the Talking Points page, married parents, a clear advantage for children. It's the one privilege liberals ignore, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Children of married parents have better outcomes on average than those in single-parent households, as economist Melissa S. Kearney shows in devastating detail in her new book, The Two-Parent Privilege. Nearly 30% of American children now live with only one parent or none, more than in any other country that tracks such data. And they are falling behind. Compared with their two-parent peers, they're less likely to finish high school, more likely to become single parents themselves, and up to five times more likely to spend childhood in poverty. Liberals have been reluctant to acknowledge this strong connection between family breakdown and poverty for fear that to do so would be patronizing or racist. But the depressing truth is that the collapse of marriage is disproportionately hurting children of color. Only 38% of black children live with married parents. The two-parent privilege is real. Yet you can't just conjure stable romantic commitments on command, said Rebecca Traister in New York Magazine. It's easy to blame mothers for failing to get or stay married, but the root problem isn't family structure. It's the racist and economically unjust policies that leave some Americans with less. That's a choice our society has made, said Annie Lowry in The Atlantic. Kearney's work shows that the two-parent advantage isn't entirely a correlate of other factors, such as education or wealth, but that marriage itself matters. But what good is it to point that out? The fact remains that a large share of children are going to grow up with one parent, while the U.S. refuses to craft policies that make sure they can thrive under those circumstances. Instead, most states require single parents to be all but destitute to qualify for assistance, and then force them to jump through bureaucratic hoops to get it. It's not single parenthood that's failing these kids. We all are. We should absolutely do more to lift children out of poverty, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But no government program can replicate the benefits of two parents with twice the time and energy. This is at heart a cultural problem, a mindset shift we need to make as a nation, starting with the progressive tastemakers of the entertainment industry. If we return to treating two-parent families as the ideal, it could help a lot of kids. And a couple of the short notes. Revenues for leading anti-vaccine groups have skyrocketed since the start of the pandemic. The Informed Consent Action Network saw its funding rise from $1.4 million in 2017 to more than $13.3 million in 2021, while Children's Health Defense, led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., saw revenues rise from about $1 million in 2018 to more than $15 million in 2021. The drastic improvement in U.S. air quality over the past two decades has been slowed or reversed in much of the country by a surge in wildfire smoke, according to a new study. States such as Montana, Colorado, and Washington have seen 50% or more of the progress they've made since 2000 rolled back. In Oregon and Nevada, wildfire smoke has completely erased any gains. Justice Clarence Thomas has twice been brought in to speak at private dinners for donors to the conservative Koch network, which has brought several cases before the Supreme Court, ProPublica reported last week. Thomas took a private jet to and from one 2018 event in Palm Springs, California. The flight was not listed on Justice Thomas's gift disclosure forms for the year. On the poll watch, 41% of Americans say they feel dread when they think about the 2024 election, while 34% report feeling exhaustion. 25% say they feel optimism. And we'll finish out with a quote from W.B. Yeats, quoted in New York Magazine, who says, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.